This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It can be stirring and glorious, but it can also be one of the easiest tunes to sing badly, really badly. Our national anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner. The history of the Star-Spangled Banner is absolutely fascinating. Bart Clegg is a musicologist with the University of Michigan, and he joins us to talk about his project, Poets and Patriots, A Tuneful History of the Star-Spangled Banner. Mark, what does this project try to accomplish?
Well, basically, the Star-Spangled Banner is turning 200 years old this year in September, and I've been getting ready for this day for like 10 years. I mean, I just want to have the biggest birthday party possible for the national anthem. And I think what's really interesting to me about it is that the story behind this ritual that we know from every sporting event, from graduations, we sing it all the time. We sing it so much that, in fact, we don't really know much about this song at all.
No.
And it turns out that the story of Francis Scott Key and this anthem and the actual dozens and dozens of versions of lyrics to this and different melodies and changes in musical style and approach, I just find it endlessly engaging for me, and it really gets at this issue of the power of this song. I mean, I think for me personally, but for so many of us.
Well, it's persisted. We haven't thrown it out and replaced it when you think about it all these years.
Exactly. There are lots of reasons why people don't like the Star-Spangled Banner. It's too hard to sing. It's associated with war. You know, it has this reputation as a drinking song. These sort of this colored history and colorful history. And I think that's, for me, what's really cool is that when you start to get into it, it really is a kind of story of America because we're complicated. We've had to compromise. We have all these different voices, all these different people coming together that have made this democratic experiment really work. And for me, the song tells that same story in a sort of vivid in an emotional and fun way.
Well, take us through first the history of the melody before it became something that Francis Scott Key knew enough about to be able to set his lyrics to. So do we know who the composer is and who and when it was written? Who wrote it and when?
We do. So it actually dates from the time of our own Revolutionary War, 1775-76. And I think it's sort of fun. The composer's name is probably the sort of ultimate American name, even though this guy is an English composer. His name is John Smith, so John Stafford Smith, to be accurate. And he was a church musician and a professional keyboardist, harpsichordist, but he also was an award-winning composer of popular song. And so this amateur musicians club that was a pretty, you know, classy and classical group of men who would get together, have a symphony concert, have a big dinner, and then sing songs for the rest of the evening. Mm-hmm. They would introduce the song portion of the evening with their club anthem. And so the Anacreontic song is a story, and it has lots of allusions to sort of Greek mythology and the poet Anacreon. And Stafford Smith set this to music.
Besides, I'll instruct you like me to entwine the myrtle of Venus with Bacchus as mine.
So did the lyrics exist and then he matched the music, or did he come up with the melody first?
That's a good question. I think probably the lyrics were written first and then the melody was done to match it. So the lyrics were written by a member of the club, Rafe Tomlinson. The music and the popularity of the club really explode at the same time, such that although this is a club song, it becomes parodied in theaters in London and becomes known in the early United States as well. So Francis Scott Key knew this tune. One of the myths I'm trying to correct about the story that we don't really know about the Star-Spangled Banner is that it wasn't someone else who put text and tune together. It was Francis Scott Key. I mean, you don't accidentally write a lyric to this really what's a sort of a funny melody. It's eight lines long. It has nine rhymes and eight lines. I mean, it's a very specific poetic form. And it was a very popular poetic form. So what Francis Scott Key does is something we call the broadside ballad tradition. And it's something, you know, we're not so familiar with today where you can, you know, record, you have recording and you can put stuff out on the internet. If you want to celebrate a song, you just put it out there.
Sure.
You know, in like, you know, 1814 when this song was written, publishing music, there's no recording extant, right? It's expensive to put out music notation. So what you did is you just put lyrics in the newspaper and you gave a hint of a popular melody that everybody already knew, and they sang the day's events, you know, something you wanted to celebrate, you know, some kind of event, a birthday, an anniversary, or in the case of Francis Scott Key, an unexpected and pivotal victory in the War of 1812.
I'm speaking with University of Michigan musicologist Mark Clegg as we talk about the Poets and Patriots Project that is really taking us all through the years in the history of our national anthem. And I'm interested in how this song that was banged out by Francis Scott Key to celebrate, as you say, a pivotal victory in the War of 1812, how did it make its way from being a patriotic chest thumper to the national anthem of the United States of America, a very lofty position?
Well, it took a long time. It took 117 years. So it doesn't become the official national anthem until, believe it or not, 1931. So it hasn't even been a century since it's been our national anthem. People think, oh, it must be like 1776.
Absolutely.
But no, it's actually quite recent. But it, in many ways, the story of our recordings is that it became the national anthem for all practical purposes long before the government got around to recognizing it and President Hoover signed
like a de facto national anthem.
Exactly. So it's really, it starts right in the aftermath of the War of 1812 and that victory. And there's sort of a beginning of sort of a coherent, you know, patriotism in the United States. And that's growing gradually up and through the Civil War. And the Civil War is sort of a key moment. At the beginning of the Civil War, interestingly enough, both the North and the South claim all of America's symbols for themselves. So the Confederacy is saying Francis Scott Key is one of ours. He's a Southerner. You know, he's from Maryland, the slave state. He's, you know, his family has been in this area forever. And this is our song and our flag. And in fact, we need to protect this sort of these wonderful symbols from the Yankees.
Yes. Right?
And then, of course, the Union is saying we need to keep everything together. We're going to use these symbols like the flag and the song as a way of pulling those together. So one of the sort of most interesting thing is that both sides write different lyrics using the Star-Spangled Banner melody for campaign songs. There's a campaign song for Lincoln. There's a campaign song for his competitors, all, again, using that same tune. And we've recorded these. So there's a tune called The Flag of Secession, right, which is about the South breaking away.
The pumpkins for fair, the foul-feeted air, gave proof through the night that the Yankees were there. Now the flag of secession in triumph doth wave.
And there's a song called Our Country's Free Flag,
which
is from the North.
From.
Yeah, exactly. So both sides are using this melody as a way of getting their word out there and saying that what's at stake is the very identity of our country. And they're using this song and the flag that are so intimately married. You know, from the moment that Francis Scott Key sees that flag over Fort McHenry, it's really the song becomes the oral equivalent of the symbol of that canvas flag.
And the flag was still there.
The flag was still there. And so it's that marriage of flag and song that really has, I think, put it so deeply into the American spirit.
But alas, we must say, in all sadness this day, some stars have seceded and wandered away, and we go to reclaim them.
Down through the years, Mark, have there been serious contenders to knock the Star-Spangled Banner off that front track of becoming our anthem? I mean, I think of the Battle Hymn of the Republic or America the Beautiful.
Right. The Star-Spangled Banner, because it's been the sort of witness to these pivotal moments in our sort of nation's history when the identity of the country has been at stake, I think it's become the national anthem really despite any kind of decision making. I mean, many people would love to see America the Beautiful be our national anthem. I mean, it's a gorgeous song.
Easier
it's sort
to
of
sing.
Spiritual. It sort of embraces the country from sea to shining sea. It's easier to sing, exactly. But, you know, the affect of that song is a kind of sort of reverie or reverence. And one of the things about a national anthem, I mean, the reason I think we sort of sing it before football games or baseball games, it's about – I mean, sports is a kind of ritual of war, right? You have different teams against each other. They're fighting it out. They're trying to be heroic. So there's this – singing our national anthem, which has this really wide melody, right? It has a what musicians would call an interval of the 12th. I mean, most national anthems are really narrow. You know, they're almost sort of dirges. You know, you're just very few notes, actually. Our national anthem has basically 12 notes from top to bottom. And but the kind of effort and heroism, the vocal heroism, the kind of commitment it takes to make that melody come off, I think is part of the spirit that we need from a national anthem. We turn to a national anthem when the country feels threatened, when we have to really defend ourselves, when we have to make something happen. It's a kind of call to action. And I think the Star-Spangled Banner galvanizes people for action in a way that America the Beautiful probably really can't. So in peacetime, America Beautiful makes sense. Mm-hmm. In wartime, you need something different, and the Star-Spangled Banner fits that mold. And I don't see it going away, despite all of the reasons why we could say, well, you know, it's a British tune, and it's, you know, it's sort of antiquated language, and it's hard to sing, and it's, you know, it has this drinking song reputation. Mm-hmm. 22 of these 37 tracks, I think, it's the first time ever they've been recorded, because they were written before recording was invented, and then they were forgotten about. And, you know, it's amazing to me that I've found literally hundreds of lyrics to this song. Every time I dig in, we find another one. And it's really just an incredible, incredible story.
Well, the national anthem has been performed in so many ways, and there really is no one correct way to sing it, right?
Right. So we've recorded the original version, the very first sheet music imprint of the Star-Spangled Banner, which we actually have at the University of Michigan in our Clements Library. It's one of 12 surviving copies. And it's actually the most valuable piece of sheet music in history. It's one piece of paper, folds in half, and it's worth $500,000 at auction, at least the most recent one. It doesn't get sold too often, as you'd imagine.
Wow.
But this is from 1814, from that fall, probably mid-October. And it's actually the sheet music is the first time that the title, the Star-Spangled Banner, is used. Because, Key's own title is In Defense of Fort McHenry. But I think it was a really savvy commercial move for the publisher to put that title on top, because he could sell it to the whole country, not just to the people in Baltimore. And it's also a key move that allows us to have that song escape, you know, the sort of history of that one little banner,
that pigeon
battle.
Yeah,
exactly,
yeah.
And become something broader, sort of a more powerful symbol of our nation. But it features one of our students at the School of Music, Justin Berkowitz, and I've had the great fortune of having really an incredible talent pool at the School of Music here at Michigan to draw on, and they've been so generous, including my colleague Jerry Blackstone, who's our choral director, who led all of these recordings. But if you listen to it, it sounds very different. So it's a solo song. Right, it's not meant for mass singing, right? So originally it was the club president, and even in Key's day, it would have been sung by a fine vocalist you would have chosen to do the solo. And then there's an echo by chorus. So it's actually, you know, about an extra two phrases longer in its original version, because that last line, you know, "Oh say does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave," that's repeated. First, it's sung by a soloist, and then it's repeated by the community, by the choir.
Almost like a little call and response.
Exactly. But it's a kind of affirmation, like, you know, this poem is here, and then the community sort of, you know, repeats and celebrates that lyric. It's a very different experience. The melody's different. It's much faster, because initially it's a party tune, right? It's a song of celebration. We won, you know, as opposed to what it's become now, which is much more hymn-like, right? So it's slow. It's sacred. At the time, it's fast. It's exciting. It's meant to be a song of celebration. So, and the melodic contour is also a little different. I mean, there's subtle details, but it's really intriguing to hear.
Mark Clegg, it's always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so very much.
Great to be here, Cindy.
Mark Clegg is a musicologist with the University of Michigan and heads up the Poets and Patriots Project.